News Break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. George W. Bush was told a month before September 11, 2001, that Al-Qaeda members were in the U.S. and the FBI had detected suspicious activity consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, according to a secret memo the White House released under pressure on Saturday. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice insisted in her public testimony to the 911 Commission last week that the memo contained mostly historical information and did not warn of any impending attacks inside the United States. Her account was contradicted by the fact that the memo included information from 3 months beforehand that Al-Qaeda members were trying to enter the United States for an attack with explosives, and there was even mention of hijacking airplanes. George W. Bush says more American casualties may come in Iraq, but we're plenty tough. Almost 50 American soldiers and more than 550 Iraqis are dead in the violence that spread across the country last week. Bush called it a tough week. Bush attended an Easter Sunday service at Fort Hood, Texas, a base that has lost at least 9 service members in the past week of fighting. After the service, Bush told reporters the U.S. campaign in Iraq is right. He says it's hard to tell if such fighting will continue. The White House is battling to keep a more than 800-page report on the 911 terror attack secret, including unheeded warnings given to Bush during the summer of 2001, suggesting that Al-Qaeda was planning an upcoming attack against the United States that raises questions about how Bush responded. One such CIA briefing in July 2001 predicted that Osama bin Laden was about to launch a terrorist strike in the coming weeks, the congressional investigators found. The intelligence briefing went on to say the attack will be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties against U.S. facilities and interests. Attack preparations have been made. Attacks will occur with little or no warning. More after this.
This week on TPTM Radio.
I see when all this hell is breaking out in Iraq. He's home clearing brush.
Well, I like what somebody says, you know, whenever there's trouble, George takes a powder. He's gone, folks.
That's what he did after that August 6th presidential briefing.
I don't see how I could possibly have imagined a plane crashing into something and destroying it. I never watched a John Wayne movie or had a drink called what? A kamikaze. They named a freaking drink after it, idiot.
TPTM Radio, on the web at TakeBackTheMedia.com.
A British man who sold all of his possessions, including his clothes, stood in a rented tuxedo on Sunday, surrounded by family and friends, and bet everything on a single spin of the roulette wheel. Ashley Revell, a 32-year-old Londoner, sold all his possessions in March, took $135,300 to the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, did some low-stakes gambling, and then placed everything he had left on red. The wheel was spun. A crowd of supporters, including his mom and dad from London, went wild. The ball bobbled over the slots and landed on red 7, and Revell walked away with $270,600. This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
The only thing madder than mad cow disease is our government's mad cow policies. Take the case of Creekstone Farms Premium Beef, a small enterprising company in Kansas that produces top quality beef. To assure both U.S. and foreign buyers that its product is free of mad cow disease, Creekstone said that it would exceed USDA's minimal testing standards and pay to have every single one of its cows privately tested. Great! Who could be against more testing and such innovative entrepreneurship? The U.S. Department of Agriculture, for one. The big beef lobbyists, for two. In another case of Bushite bourgeois, USDA notified Creekstone that it does not allow private testing, even by certified labs. This from an administration that's privatizing everything from its wars to your water supply. Why? The official rationale is that only the government can assure food safety. But how can testing 100% of cows be less safe than USDA's program that inspects less than 1%? The real reason for USDA's intransigence is that the big beef companies don't want to do 100% testing themselves, and they want no competition from anyone who does. They say that Creekstone's testing would, quote, mislead us consumers, for we might think that 100% testing produces a safer product. Aside from the fact that more testing does assure more safety, Creekstone is not even making such a claim. It's only claiming that, indeed, it tests 100% of its cows. Then it's up to us consumers to decide in the marketplace which beef we prefer. But the Bushites and the big beef lobbyists refuse to allow such consumer choice, declaring that Creekstone cannot advertise that every ounce of its beef is fully tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a pile of BS! To help bring sanity to Washington's mad cow policies, call the USDA's comment office, 202-720-5627.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC worked not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec? Nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to Monday, friends. It's Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Great to be back with you the 12th of March here. So much. They declassified this thing over the weekend, the presidential daily briefing, and now it's there's talk. Did Condoleezza Rice commit perjury? Did Condoleezza Rice commit perjury? Very difficult issue coming up here, maybe soon for the Bush administration. On this day, April 12th in 1945, one of who I consider one of the four best presidents of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, died. In Warm Springs, Georgia. He was 63 years old. I just want to share a couple of clips from his first inaugural. This was the depths of the Great Depression, and Franklin Roosevelt had just been elected to bring us back from the edge that the conservative economic policies of Republicans Herbert Hoover and those immediately preceding him had dropped us off into, that being, of course, the Great Depression. And it starts with perhaps one of his most famous comments.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and of vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. And I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days.
That leadership being his, of course. That we've had tough times. I mean, keep in mind, this was 1932. This was unbelievably bad, one of the worst economic periods in American history. And then he said, and here's how we're going to fix it. And this, you know, it's just amazing to me how today's politicians don't get it. I mean, there's a few out there. And I'm not even sure John Kerry gets it, that there's this huge multiplier effect. There, and see, what we're seeing right now is the divider effect. But the multiplier effect has been well known. If somebody gets a job, they earn an income and they spend money. The money that they spend then it provides, you know, for other people's jobs. You know, I get a job, I've got a paycheck, I go down to the 7-Eleven, I buy something, now there's a guy there who's, and on it goes. I mean, it just, and he gets a paycheck, and there's this incredible multiplier effect. Once you start growing jobs, it just, you know, it echoes and echoes and echoes and grows larger and larger. There's also a divider effect. And this is the one the conservatives don't really want you to know about. But it's very real. And as people lose jobs, then they're no longer spending money at the local store, and so the local store then goes out of business, and now you've got more people out of work, and you've got this cascading effect. And the way that the government, and people say, oh, government doesn't create jobs, private industry creates jobs. Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, about a third of the workforce of the United States is directly or indirectly paid by government. But beyond that, what Roosevelt did was he said, okay, we can get this multiplier effect going. We will make the, you know, if there's people out of work and they want to work, we will make, and we're not going to give them welfare. We're not going to hand them cash and say, here, you know, goof off, here's some money. We're going to say we will become the employer of last resort. This was the Works Progress Administration and other efforts like it. And by becoming the employer of last resort, we will stimulate, we'll jumpstart this. Now, the Bush administration's idea of stimulating the economy is giving multimillionaires huge tax cuts so that they can stash more money offshore and dumping hundreds of billions of dollars into Iraq, some part of which is coming back to the United States. I mean, there is a multiplier effect to that. A little later on in the program, we're going to go through all the members of the Bush family and how much profit they're making off this war. And what you see is this, you know, very, very clear thing that as money gets handed out to large defense contractors, that they, you know, they do create some jobs in the United States and create demand for products in the United States. And so we have growth. The downside of it, though, is that number one, we're creating the infrastructure for another country. And number two, we're creating weapons with a lot of this money to replace the ones we used. And the problem is, see, if you take $1 billion and you build bridges with it, you've got something that for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, maybe even 100 years, is going to enhance the productivity of America. It's a bridge. It's part of a transportation system. So you spend that $1 billion, and over time you get back 5, 10, 15, 20, $100 billion in value from it. But if you spend that $1 billion building a bridge in Iraq, well, you'll get some of that money back in the form of salaries that come back to the United States if you hire Halliburton to do it, or Bechtel. But the bridge is not going to be productive for the United States. And you could argue, well, you know, they're helping to build democracy in the middle. We'll see. Okay. But in any case, there's not that immediate and long-term and lasting productivity for the United States, number one. And number two, perhaps more important, most of the money, you know, only $17 billion is going to reconstruction. Most of the money is going to replace bombs that we used and to, you know, make larger military contraptions. And when you blow up a bomb, there is no multiplier effect there either. It doesn't create a job for somebody. It doesn't. It's not. You know, if you build a bomb, and when you explode a bomb, that money is gone. It's not like you built an office building. It's not like you planted a forest. I mean, Roosevelt with the WPA, they were building roads, they were rebuilding forests, they were putting together national parks, they were even doing artwork. And so anyway, Roosevelt goes on about, you know, how he's going to put this back together.
In such, this nation is asking for action, and action now. Yeah. Our greatest primary task is to put people to work.
Yes. And as it is now, you see.
This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously.
Unfortunately, something beyond the ability of the Bush administration.
It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources.
And so, you know, he lays it out. He says, this is how it works, and, you know, very, very straightforward. And, you know, simple stuff. It's not rocket science. Well, it is if you're George Bush, but it wasn't for Franklin Roosevelt. On April 12th, 1945, Franklin Roosevelt died in Warm Springs, Georgia, and we lost a great president. So, moving along here, we've got, boy, did you see, I missed the show, but I heard about it. Saturday Night Live, Janet Jackson. She's, it was John Ashcroft's idea, says Cheney in the skit on Saturday Night Live. He suggests to Condi Rice that she should flash a boob, like, you know, and so Janet Jackson does this. It's the skit showed Vice President Dick Cheney, CNN, said, played by Daryl Hammond, suggesting Rice should do this to distract the public from her testimony. He says, just one headlight real quick. It does two things. You win over the liberals, plus it's a distraction for the press. I guarantee that's going to be the headline, not the bin Laden thing. Rice then, you know, Jackson as Rice then refuses. It was an interesting story. So, a couple of things to share with you here. I got an email. This does such a great job of putting this into perspective. This is an email from Rodney. He doesn't say where he's located. He says, I have a son in the U.S. Army station in Korea. He tells me of the strong ties between himself and his military brothers and sisters. His unit is soon to go to Iraq, but he is going to go with them, but he is not going to go with them for medical reasons, so he feels he's letting his unit down and worries for their safety. It is also true of many of our soldiers that come home on leave from Iraq. They want to get back over there and get the job done so that every U.S. soldier can come home. My son also tells me that there are great concerns of people in the military with regard to the path that George W. Bush is taking us down, and the military is saying, don't vote for Bush. So let's support our troops and vote the son of a Bush out, he says. And this is the dichotomy. I mean, this difficult thing. We all want to support our troops. And we had a caller last week from Kevin. He's a regular in our chat room, whose son is over there in Iraq. And you know, this has got to be a very, very difficult time. These are the troops, the soldiers. They're not just some them. This is us. This is the youth of our nation that George Bush has committed to attack Iraq because of the clear and imminent danger that Iraq represented to the United States with its massive stores of weapons of mass destruction and its nuclear programs. And it's, which of course turned out not to be there. And so now, you know, now we've got this thing. The truce, we declared a truce this weekend around a religious event. Wanted to tell you about this. I find interesting. This and perhaps kind of scary. It's called Arbaeen, or Arbaeen, and this is a holiday that commemorates the death of the grandson of Muhammad, and that grandson's name was Hussein. And everybody, to celebrate this holiday, everybody goes to Karbala and does this pilgrimage. And so we've declared the truce for this, but it is getting thicker and thicker, this mixture of religion and politics in Iraq, and more treacherous for us. And increasingly it's obvious that George Bush has no plan for this, no way to get out of it, nothing. And yes, actually, John Kerry does, but we'll leave that to John Kerry to tell you about it. Anyhow, 20 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
You.
What?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Yeah, okay. Can you tell me who Louis Armstrong was?
He was the first guy on the moon.
Mm.
You know, one small step for man.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance and Armstrong's horn. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and...
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface, and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. I said it was March. It's April. It's April. It's April 12th. Yes. Oh, this is not a replay. This is live radio, friends. And, yeah, sometimes that happens. Here's the interesting issue now. Is the presidential daily briefing that the White House released over the weekend, presumably hoping it would get buried in the news cycle? You know, it's always, you know, get bad news out on Friday nights or Saturdays, and of course they did that. Is this thing the real thing? I don't want to diminish it by calling it a conspiracy theory. There are questions being asked, let's say. CNN posted the August 6th presidential daily briefing, the one in which Bush was warned. In fact, here's some actual quotes from it. The title, of course, is Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. It says, after U.S. missile strikes on his base in Afghanistan in 1998, Bin Laden told followers he wanted to retaliate in Washington. An Egyptian Islamic Jihad operative told a redacted portion service at the same time that Bin Laden was planning to exploit the operative's access to the U.S. to mount a terrorist strike. Goes on to say, Bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft. And then it adds, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. And then it wraps up saying, CIA and FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in the United Arab Emirates in May, saying that a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. So it's like, well, you know, we got a little advance warning there. A little advance warning. Well, anyhow, here's the question that's being raised. You look at the document that's been released, and page one is in one typeface and font, and page two is in a different font, a different typeface, and a slightly different layout. And the question is, was there more to this than just this page and a half that the White House released? And in fact, the German news weekly Die Zeit 2 years ago reported that the PDB was 11 and a half pages on that day. 1-866-889-8894, your thoughts on this. John in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom?
Yeah.
I thought it, within a couple days of 9/11, what occurred to me was in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, there was, the blind shake.
Al Rahman.
There was some intelligence that Bin Laden was going to try to hijack a plane to get his freedom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's what's referred to in this memo, John. I got to drop you. I'm sorry that you're just breaking up really, really badly. But you know, I get the point, and I'm assuming that you're saying what a lot of people are saying here is that this was a warning, which raises the issue: did Condi Rice lie under oath before the commission last week when she said it wasn't a warning, when she said we couldn't have anticipated? How could we have known? It was a mystery to us. We're just baffled. Maybe not. 29 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
When Bush got into the driver's seat, he took over the largest surplus in American history and turned that surplus into the largest deficit in history. The U.S. economy has lost 3.3 million jobs, the most since the Great Depression. Then Bush drove us into war with Iraq. We're losing lives. We're hemorrhaging money. And these costs are driving our country closer to bankruptcy. Just where does George Bush think he's taking...
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Sterling workers in the greater Washington, D.C. area are finally headed back to work this week after a 7-month-long strike. Under the settlement, Sterling managers agreed to accept their employees' union should the majority show their support for one. They did, and now the mostly immigrant workforce has joined the United Needle Industries and Textile Employees Union, or UNITE. The union has since negotiated a 3-year contract agreement with Sterling, bringing workers a pension plan, free individual and family health coverage, and the largest wage increase in company history.
New proposed rule changes from the Environmental Protection Agency would threaten the health and safety of workers at industrial laundry companies. The EPA is considering waiving the rules that require rags and linen soaked with solvents to be treated as toxic waste. The change would allow this laundry to go straight to the cleaners without the currently intervening step of decontaminating it. The change is the product of heavy lobbying from industrial laundry companies themselves, the largest of which contributed more than $1 million to Republicans in the 2000 election cycle and have raised an estimated $500,000 for George W. Bush's 2004 campaign.
For the first time in South Korean history, unemployed part-time day laborers and migrant workers will be part of a labor union associated with the Federation of Korean Trade Unions. Earlier this month, the Korean Supreme Court ruled that anyone in a temporary jobless state can qualify for union membership, paving the way for a union of jobless and irregular and migrant workers. The new organization is pledged to work towards equalizing the rights of permanent and temporary employees, and it hopes to win greater rights for South Korea's burgeoning population of migrant workers.
Clothier Land's End, in deference to pressure from workers' rights groups and resultant boycotts from several universities, has agreed to work on problems with union busting at a factory in El Salvador that produces its merchandise. Land's End will monitor the Primo factory for 12 months and make donations to another more union-friendly factory in El Salvador where many of those blacklisted at Primo now work. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. How widespread is worker abuse in China? A lot wider than you think. A former International Labor Organization investigator told the U.S. Senate recently that up to 80% of the Chinese contractors making goods for U.S. companies bend or break that country's labor law outright. Most often broken are minimum wage and overtime standards. Senate testimony suggests contractors keep 2 or even 3 sets of books to hide the practice.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Against you, girl, get back in bed.
And that was the message to Connie Rice when Bob Carey took her on.
He said the president was tired of swatting flies. Can you tell me one example where the president swatted a fly when it came to Al Qaeda prior to 9/11?
I think what the president was speaking
what fly had he swatted?
Well, the disruptions abroad was what he was really focusing on. When CIA would go after Abbas Abeda, go after this guy. And
Dr. Rice, we only swatted a fly once on the 20th of August, 1998. We didn't swat any flies afterwards. How could he be tired?
He's so tired. Makes me think of that. What's that song from Blazing Saddles? I'm tired! the president, he's so tired of swatting flies. Yes, indeed. It's a difficult one. Well, anyhow, we've got this presidential daily briefing. Yeah, let me read you the story from Die Zeit, the German newsweekly. It's like Time Magazine of Germany. Quote, his presidential daily briefing runs 11 and a half printed pages instead of the usual 2 or 3 and carries the title, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. Therein, the CIA chief explains that al-Qaeda has decided to carry out attacks within the United States and that presumably members of the terrorist organization have been in the country for some time. End quote. That was published 2 years ago in Germany. It named the presidential deal, this great secret that they've been keeping from the American people. We can't let people know the name of the presidential daily briefing. No, siree. Can't let them know that. Anyhow, I want to get into this in some more detail. Dave in Eureka's on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up? 1-866-888-9894 the number, by the way. Yeah, I guess you figured that out, Dave. What's up?
I did. Tom, I've been trying with your help to unravel the massive hoaxes that are being perpetrated against us.
Good luck, Dave. It's huge!
Well, I know, but I think some basic assumptions, some basic clues. You know, one is that a key to it, I think, is big special interest money, corrupt, very corrupt special interest money, dumps megabucks into this Bush administration. They dump it into politicians in general. Then these politicians get themselves into office, whether honorably elected or rigging the election, they get in. They then, in turn, appoint heads of various departments, government officials. They appoint, among others, the Attorney General, the head of the FBI. Now, we are naively going to assume that we still have an FBI that's nobly in the business of fighting crime and enforcing law. No. What we've got now is an extension, a police force of a very corrupt government agency.
Well, I think we have both. I think we have both. There are a lot of good people in the FBI who are trying to do good work.
Are you aware, though, of the number of calls? Right now I've got a big hollow echo in the background, and I get it whenever I call you. You get an inordinate amount of calls that are sudden, very, very difficult to hear. Do we know what the status is right now of the bill to get a paper backup for voting machines? Is that moving along? Do we know? Or?
It's not going to make it out of committee. The Republicans are not going to allow a vote on these things.
Boy, I tell you, this is the hoax that we got to be dealing with. This is the reality we're faced with right now.
It's one of several, Dave. I mean, you know, it's one of several. And yes, I agree that the FBI has been exploited and abused under John Ashcroft. And I don't think that you can indict all, you know, everybody involved with it. But you know, we're back to the Nixon days. You know, we're back to the Red Scare. And with regard to the electronic voting machine, yes, it's a problem. And it's just you know, on and on it goes. I mean, there's lots and lots of these. You know, we're back to the Red Scare. And with regard to the electronic voting machine, yes, it's a problem. And it's just you know, on and on it goes. I mean, there's lots and lots of stuff. Dave, thanks for the call. I appreciate your comments and catching us up. Now, what's going on? Here we've got the United States, you know, still under threat, Condi Rice. What did Condi Rice say last week? We are not safe. We're safer, but we're not safe. And so George Bush this weekend goes bass fishing. In fact, last week, too, on Thursday, he opened his expansive Central Texas ranch, the former pig farm, that he bought just in time for his inauguration in 2000. No horses, please. He's afraid of horses. But pig farm is fine. And they built a nice little pond on it and have stocked it with fish. Anyhow, and on Thursday, he opened it up to sporting aficionados and conservation groups like the National Rifle Association, 23 representatives of such groups. The NRA had just given $390,000, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And, he just cut the EPA budget by 7% for next year. John Kerry says, I notice President Bush is taking some time off down in Crawford, Texas. I'm told that he takes these days off. When he takes these days off, he totally relaxes. He doesn't watch television, doesn't read newspapers, doesn't make long-term plans, doesn't worry about the economy. He says, I thought about that for a moment, and it sounds to me like that's just like life in Washington. In other words, that's kind of normal for George. Well, is that a cheap shot or not? I mean, you know, here, and then, of course, the news in today's paper, President Bush showed his prowess as a bass fisherman Friday with the host of a popular outdoors program. You know, I'd rather know his prowess as somebody who's going to make our economy work, but That's not on the agenda. He took the biggest one of the day, says Roland Martin, host of the Outdoor Life Network program Fishing with Roland Martin. It was a four-pound bass. The TV host said Bush is, quote, a very accomplished fisherman. He handled the tackle really well and caught three fish. Well, I'm just so pleased to know that. I'm sure you are, too. But in the meantime, we have this presidential daily briefing, and then beyond that, we have John Ashcroft tomorrow testifying before the committee, and we have some suggested questions for him. Let's get the presidential daily briefing out of the way first, though. I think this is just absolutely remarkable. The Center for American Progress did a great summary on this. David Sirota put this thing together. The White House this weekend released a section of the classified August 6th, 2001 presidential daily briefing, which explicitly warned Bush of an imminent al-Qaeda attack inside the United States. The document contradicts President Bush's own denials and raises the question of whether Condi Rice, here's the question, did Condi Rice lie under oath last week in describing the memo's contents? I don't think she went in there thinking that the name of this memo, which is Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., would ever be revealed. And I certainly don't think she ever thought the memo itself would be declassified. And it may be that only part of it has been. We're really not sure here. The president said yesterday, quote, the memo did not contain enough specific threat information, end quote. He said the PDB was no indication of a terrorist threat and that it said nothing about an attack on America. This is a quote from the President of the United States yesterday. Yesterday. But you go back and you read the presidential daily briefing. And an Egyptian Islamic Jihad operative told the service that Bin Laden was planning to exploit the operative's access to the U.S. to mount a terrorist strike. Bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft. FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings of other types of attacks or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of buildings in New York. CIA and FBI officials are planning to call our embassy in the UAE. Oh, they're investigating a call to our embassy from May, saying that a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks. Okay, that's what those are the words. But George Bush says, "Well, I said nothing about an attack on America." Quote end quote. So. This I think here's, you know, the spinmeisters are going to be out in droves today on this thing. I mean, the landscape of right wing talk radio is just going to be just they've got to figure out a way to make up, down, and left, right, to make white, black, and black, white. You know, they got to figure out a way, because it's looking increasingly like this briefing indicates that Condi Rice not only filibustered, but lied under oath. 1-866-889-8894, our number, 17 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Greg in Los Alamos is on the line. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Tom, I'm not sure what the time frame is, but I know the phrase using hijacked airplanes as missiles was brought up several times. Why isn't this tied into this presidential briefing?
Well, that goes way back. I mean, there have been a half a dozen different cases where that was raised as a scenario. Richard Clark, of course, thought that there was a possibility for the Olympics in Atlanta, which was almost a decade ago, when Condi Rice and George Bush were in Davos, Switzerland, I believe it is. They put up a perimeter of anti-aircraft missiles because they thought that was a possibility. I mean, this is not a new thing, Greg. This is but you know, according to the president, let's just continue with the vacation. Let's just continue with the vacation.
Yeah.
In her testimony under oath before the 9/11 Commission last week, Condi Rice said the August 6 PDB was, quote, historical information based on old reporting. There was no new threat information, and it did not, in fact, warn of any coming attacks against inside the United States. That's a verbatim quote from Condi Rice last week. She was, no specific warning. Well, here's a little bit of a, back and forth. Richard Benveniste.
Now, you knew by August 2001 of Al-Qaeda involvement in the first World Trade Center bombing. Is that correct? You knew that in 1999, late 99, in the Millennium Threat period, that we had thwarted an Al-Qaeda attempt to blow up Los Angeles International Airport and thwarted cells operating in Brooklyn, New York, and Boston, Massachusetts. As of the August 6th briefing, you learned that Al-Qaeda members have resided or traveled to the United States for years and maintained a support system in the United States.
This is kind of, let me give you A and B and C. Do you see a pattern in these dots, Dr. Rice?
And you learned that FBI information since the 1998 blind shake warning of hijackings to free the blind shake indicated a pattern of suspicious activity in the country up until August 6th, consistent with preparation for hijackings. Isn't that so?
Yes. But, again, this was, one of those, filibuster the thing. This is Condi Rice. It did not, in fact, warn of any coming attacks inside the United States. This was her response. But this PDB did contain very current and specific information about ongoing investigations and threats, a direct contradiction of Rice's testimony. This from David Sirota and the folks at the Center for American Progress. Very well-done investigation of this. The PDB said there were patterns of, quote, patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-field investigations throughout the U.S. that it considers bin Laden-related, including one following leads about bin Laden supporters in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. But the president himself... It gets even more Byzantine. The president himself is insisting that the reason he got that briefing is because he had personally asked for it. He said, quote, I asked the intelligence agency to analyze the data to tell me whether or not we faced a threat internally. That's what the PDB request was, end quote. That's what the president said. But according to the CIA, quote, the briefing was not requested by President Bush, end quote. As Commissioner Benveniste disclosed, quote, the CIA informed this panel that the author of the briefing does not recall such a request from Bush and that the idea to compile the briefing came from within the CIA, end quote. Hey, another inconsistency, a lapse between, a discrepancy between the truth and the words coming out of the mouths of George W. Bush. The Washington Post explored the Bush administration's claims that, quote, the President of the United States had us at battle stations, end quote, during the summer of 2001. But if top officials were at battle stations, this is from the Washington Post, if top officials were at battle stations, there was no sign of it on the surface. Bush spent most of August 2001 on his ranch, really on his pig farm, taking one of the longest presidential vacations in White House history. One former Bush aide... This again from the Washington Post, who remains close to the White House, said the use of the term battle stations by Rice was an overstatement. An overstatement. Remarkable. Was America, you know, what did the president know and when did he know it, and could he have protected this nation better? This is going to be one of the big issues in the election. Mark my words. It's Tom Hartman, 10 minutes before the hour.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
New UN regulations for commercial shipping address a major problem with tiny stowaways. I'm Richard Hooks for Earthwatch Radio. Global trade and shipping has given rise to a global problem with foreign organisms that travel in the ballast water of ships. The United Nations recently adopted the first international standards to deal with this problem. Ship owners and ports will have more than 5 years to put them into practice, but these new regulations for handling ballast water will be mandatory. Ships routinely take in ballast water when they're traveling without cargo, and they dump it when they get to their destinations. The ballast water is essential for keeping the ship stable at sea. The problem is that the water is usually filled with plants and animals, and when they're released into foreign waters, they can wreak havoc on native species. Jim Corbett is a marine policy expert at the University of Delaware. Corbett says the regulations show that the international community is responding to some environmental effects of global commerce. He says the regulations set mandatory standards for treating ballast water to filter out or kill invading organisms before the ballast is dumped out. He says these are the first regulations of their kind, and if the global standards don't provide enough protection for coastal ecosystems, he says the rules allow countries to set even stricter standards.
The recognition in this treaty that regions may set stricter standards is really very important and does demonstrate that the international community understands the nature of this global problem and its regional differences.
The new ballast water rules were adopted in February by the UN's International Maritime Organization. Corbett says ships will have 5 to 12 years to adopt treatment technologies that meet the new standards. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's what it took. We had to hear it through the grapevine. 2 years ago, this was published in the German news weekly, Die Zeit. And we finally, it finally gets declassified on Saturday. The Minneapolis Star Tribune, the newspaper in Minneapolis, their editorial board, they put together an editorial, and they said that George Bush's pre 9/11 conduct, quote, displayed a criminal lack of interest in trying to prevent an attack in the United States that the administration had strong reason to expect. They went on to say almost nothing of a defensive nature was done to guard against, to prevent, the horrible spectacle that unfolded on 9/11. And I think, you know, more and more Americans are starting to wake up to this. This guy let us down badly. Badly. Oh, we were only in office 8 months, but you knew. This is, Sandy Berger said to Condi Rice, "You are this is your issue," and they said, "No, we'd rather really plan on the divide up the oil fields in Iraq." 1-866-889-8894. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. Have you heard anything about Reliant Energy of Houston being indicted?
Yeah. Yeah, I read the story, I thought, on the air last week. If I didn't, I intended to. That happened last, Thursday, wasn't it? Wednesday or Thursday of last week?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. For manipulating energy prices in California, for those of, for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about. They had on tape telephone conversations of some of their employees saying, we're gonna shut down part of the energy grid, and we're gonna do this to drive prices up, and we're gonna grab the market. And this is the wonders of deregulation, friends. When you've got a natural monopoly, that's what happens. So, Armin, your point here in 10 seconds or less?
My point here in 10 seconds or less. Conspiracy is what it is, in my opinion.
There you go. Okay. Thanks, Armin. I appreciate it. And the conspiracy, of course, was to screw California consumers in that case. But, it goes on and on. CBS poll, most Americans believe the White House is covering something up or lying to us. This is going to be big in politics. It's Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The newsletter factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the newsletter factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the newsletter factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. George W. Bush was told a month before September 11, 2001, that al-Qaeda members were in the U.S. and the FBI had detected suspicious activity consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, according to a secret memo the White House released under pressure on Saturday. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice insisted in her public testimony to the 911 Commission last week that the memo contained mostly historical information and did not warn of any impending attacks inside the United States. Her account was contradicted by the fact that the memo included information from 3 months beforehand that al-Qaeda members were trying to enter the United States for an attack with explosives, and there was even mention of hijacking airplanes. George W. Bush says more American casualties may come in Iraq, but we're plenty tough. Almost 50 American soldiers and more than 550 Iraqis are dead in the violence that spread across the country last week. Bush called it a tough week. Bush attended an Easter Sunday service at Fort Hood, Texas, a base that has lost at least 9 service members in the past week of fighting. After the service, Bush told reporters the U.S. campaign in Iraq is right. He says it's hard to tell if such fighting will continue. The White House is battling to keep a more than 800-page report on the 911 terror attack secret, including unheeded warnings given to Bush during the summer of 2001, suggesting that al-Qaeda was planning an upcoming attack against the United States that raises questions about how Bush responded. One such CIA briefing in July 2001 predicted that Osama bin Laden was about to launch a terrorist strike in the coming weeks, the congressional investigators found. The intelligence briefing went on to say the attack will be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties against U.S. facilities and interests. Attack preparations have been made. Attacks will occur with little or no warning. More after this.
This week on TPTM Radio.
I see when all this hell is breaking out in Iraq. He's home clearing brush.
Well, I like what somebody says, you know, whenever there's trouble, George takes a powder. He's gone, folks.
That's what he did after that August 6th presidential briefing.
I don't see how I could possibly have imagined a plane crashing into something and destroying it. I never watched a John Wayne movie or had a drink called what? A kamikaze. They named a freaking drink after it, idiot.
TPTM Radio, on the web at takebackthemedia.com.
A British man who sold all of his possessions, including his clothes, stood in a rented tuxedo on Sunday, surrounded by family and friends, and bet everything on a single spin of the roulette wheel. Ashley Revelle, a 32-year-old Londoner, sold all his possessions in March, took $135,300 to the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, did some low-stakes gambling, and then placed everything he had left on red. The wheel was spun. A crowd of supporters, including his mom and dad from London, went wild. The ball bobbled over the slots and landed on red 7, and Revelle walked away with $270,600. This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Despite George W.'s recent cheerleading effort to convince us that sizz boom ba, the economy is surging and the boom is back, most Americans are shaking their heads and saying, a boom for whom? With the massive offshoring of both blue-collar and white-collar jobs, and with the Walmartization of wages and benefits here at home, it's no longer just the unskilled, down-and-out, abject poor who are left out by our boom-boom economy, but also skilled, formerly middle-class workers. There's a quiet crisis spreading in the America that Washington and Wall Street either never visit or ignore. I'm not talking about the inner cities, but the middle-class suburbs, where even hunger is a growing problem. Food insecurity, as the jargonists label it, is up by 15% in the last 4 years. That's 1.5 million new people now struggling to put food on their tables. One soup kitchen serving 11 Connecticut suburbs says 80% of its clients have jobs. Mostly low-wage, no-benefit, Walmartized jobs. Likewise, affordable housing needs have long been ignored by both government and commercial developers, so 94 million of our people now have significant housing problems. That's one-third of the population of the richest country on earth. Worse, 40 million of us now have housing problems ranked as severe, meaning their housing is either severely substandard, severely unaffordable, or both. Housing prices go up, while most people's incomes stay flat or go down, and the affordable housing crisis mushrooms. Meanwhile, the richest among us get the bulk of federal housing subsidies. Not only do multimillionaires enjoy full mortgage deductibility on their main mansions, but also on their Park Avenue condo, their Aspen getaway home, and the summer place at the beach. This is Jim Hightower saying, if the elites continue to ignore the hard realities faced by a growing majority of us, they'll need to build mighty high fences around their own compounds.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec? Nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr.
For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 7 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Not only do we know, writes David Sirota of the Center for American Progress, not only do we know that the administration was warned on August 6th about a possible domestic al-Qaeda attack, but they were also warned 3 months earlier. Page 204 of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 noted that, quote, in May of 2001, the intelligence community obtained a report that bin Laden supporters were planning to infiltrate the United States to carry out a terrorist operation. This was back in May, but George Bush still had to take the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency in August. I mean, you know, it's the thing to do, I guess. The report was included in an intelligence report for senior government officials. In August, the Pentagon acquired and shared with other elements of the intelligence community information suggesting that 7 persons associated with bin Laden had departed various locations for Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Which brings up, here's the two stories that in my mind are not getting the kind of attention, the kind of focus, the kind of that they deserve. Not just. You know, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to know? But these are two issues that are crucial and pivotal to the question of how did our intelligence fail so badly? I mean, we succeeded in stopping 3 different al-Qaeda attacks during the Clinton administration. How did we fail so badly during the Bush administration? Well, we know now that once that transition was made from Clinton to Bush, they immediately stopped the daily meetings on terrorism. They changed it from something at the level of the office of the president, which had been happening in the Clinton administration, to in the Bush administration, giving it to Dick Cheney and saying, create a task force. That the task force never met. Although his energy task force was meeting regularly behind closed doors with Ken Lay and friends to carve up the oil fields of Iraq before 9/11. But anyhow, the two things that in my mind are you know, really get to the question of what could have been done, what should we be doing, how do we know, you know, what's going on? Not just who do we blame. I'm frankly, you know, I think that that's an interesting one because it does have to do with politics ultimately, and we do hold our politicians accountable. And when they do screw up, we do say, hey, you know, either fix it or leave office. And this, you know, this administration clearly is bent on doing neither. But in any case, the two big questions before in my mind are, number one, what about this 140 Saudis who were evacuated while all the other planes were grounded in the days immediately following 9/11, number one. And number two, what is John Ashcroft? Why hasn't John Ashcroft been held to account? I mean, Condi kept, in her testimony, Dr. Rice kept, you know, implying, well, you know, the FBI really should have been handling it. This was really the, and they, you know, and there's this pretty broad consensus that the FBI dropped the ball on this thing. So I've got some questions here suggested for John Ashcroft. He'll be testifying tomorrow. That will be the big story. It'll be interesting to see how much coverage he gets. I think this could be explosive, although the guy is a very, very competent politician, even though he couldn't win against a dead guy. You'll recall when John Ashcroft was running for the Senate from his own state of Missouri, the people who knew him best, his opponent, Mel Carnahan, died in a still unexplained plane accident 2 weeks before the election. Sort of like Paul Wellstone, you know. I mean, the circumstances were nearly identical. And yet, the dead guy, Mel Carnahan, he was dead now. His name was still on the ballot, and the voters of Missouri, nonetheless, voted for him instead of Ashcroft. You know, they had seen Ashcroft play senator, and they didn't really want to have anything to do with it, I think. So, you know, here you've got a guy who is a competent and wily politician, and it's going to be real interesting to see how he gets around this. But let's look at these. Well, actually, let's get right to that. Here are some questions. 10 questions for John Ashcroft that Judd Legume put together. He's with the Center for American Progress. And this was sent to us by David Sirota. 10 key questions the commissioner should ask, and the background for them. And so tomorrow, when you're watching that hearing, or if you're listening to it on the radio on C-SPAN or whatever, think about these. Number one, if counterterrorism was a top priority for the Justice Department prior to 9/11, why did you, Mr. Ashcroft, ignore the FBI's specific request in August 2001 for additional counterterrorism resources? Keep in mind that in August of 2001, the month before 9/11, the FBI submitted their internal budget request to John Ashcroft's Department of Justice. They wanted 248 counterterrorism agents and support staff, 54 translators to review a backlog of foreign language intelligence, and 200 professional intelligence researchers to analyze the intelligence. But when Ashcroft submitted his final, this from Judd Legume, when Ashcroft submitted his final budget request to the White House on September 10th, 2001, 24 hours before the al-Qaeda attacks, he did not request funding for any of the FBI's urgent needs. In fact, he proposed cuts in counterterrorism efforts, including a $65 million reduction for counterterrorism equipment grants, a $20 million reduction for border control, and a $1.4 million reduction for the National Domestic Preparedness Office. Of the 68 programs where Ashcroft proposed increases, not one single one Not one. Not one involved counterterrorism. Now, in the previous year, in Janarino's budget for 2000, counterterrorism was her top priority. And the vast majority of the budget and funding increases that she asked for had to do with counterterrorism. John Ashcroft was far more concerned with pornography on the Internet, the sale of bongs and cigarette papers on the Internet, and social crimes, shall we say. One of his big issues was the fact that a number of states were making medical marijuana illegal. And, you know, you got to crack down on that. Got to get rid of that. So what was he thinking? Question number one. Why, you know, Mr. Ashcroft, why did you cut funding for counterterrorism in the months leading up to 9/11? Why did you, I mean, you know, the Clinton administration, they were, you know, they're running around with their hair on fire, lobbing cruise missiles into, 60 cruise missiles into Afghanistan trying to kill bin Laden. They stopped, you know, the bombing of Los Angeles. They stopped a couple of other plots. They finally figured out 3 weeks before they handed over the keys to George Bush that the USS Cole had been hit by Osama bin Laden. And they said, well, you know, we could go after him on this. But in 3 weeks, you're going to be president, and we don't want to hand you a, you know, a Bay of Pigs here. We're not going to hand you a war. You can make your own decisions. But here's what we think you should do. You should go after this guy. He's, you know, as Sandy Berger said to Condi Rice, this is going to be your number one priority. And as George Bush said, no, it's not. No. Missile defense is going to be our number one priority. We need to fight the Soviet Union. But, Mr. President, there is no Soviet Union anymore. Well, I don't care. Don Rumsfeld made millions as a lobbyist for the Star Wars industry, and he's now our Secretary of Defense, and he tells me it's real important that we have a missile defense to protect us against those Soviet missiles, even though we've never been able to test the thing successfully, even though it's never worked, even though we spent $2 trillion on it that we had to borrow from future generations, even though right now every 3 months we pay $165 billion in interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up, handing missile defense money over to his good buddies, the same good buddies as Don Rumsfeld, by the way. That's more important than who sunk the USS Cole. Come on, that's old history. Get over it. That happened on Clinton's watch. We're not going to retaliate for the USS Cole, no. Question number two for Mr. Ashcroft tomorrow in our dreams. He outlined in May 2001 memo to his department heads 7 strategic goals. John Ashcroft. He said there are 7 major priorities for the coming year. They were reducing gun violence, protecting the rights of crime victims, strengthening the Internal Justice Department financial systems, and a few other things. Counterterrorism was not even mentioned. By August 2001, Ashcroft had created a strategic plan document to spotlight his priorities. Out of his 36 objectives, he highlighted 11 in yellow. The document explained highlighted-AG goal. In other words, these are the Attorney General's goals, the highlighted ones. Although objective 1.3 was to combat terrorist activities, it was not highlighted. So the question is, why not? Why not? Why was combating terrorism, or specifically combating Islamic radicalism, not one of the priorities of the Attorney General of the United States? When he had these reports that bin Laden wanted to strike in the United States, that he was in the United States, that they had sleeper cells in the United States, he had all this information that the president had, it wasn't even on his radar. 1-866-889-8894, Steve in Humboldt County is on the line. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, this is a little bit off subject. I do appreciate what you're talking about. Something that I've been wondering recently is, aren't we required to have Congress declare war before we go into a war?
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's what the Constitution says. Only Congress has the power to make war. And the last time we declared a war was World War II. So.
And so how is it that we're at war in Iraq?
Well, we're legally not. We're technically not, although it's a police action, but it's not a declared war. It's frankly, Steve, it's a mess. It's just an absolute mess. And this is the wonderful world of George Bush. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 20 minutes after the hour, we'll be right back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
You know that grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE, and that is ECOWINE.
In my country, a group of religious extremists are reshaping the government to promote their own agenda and morality.
The government can keep a list of everyone I call, and they do not need a judge's permission.
Our citizens are seized and held in prison without being charged of a crime, without the right to a trial, and without a lawyer. Why should you care about what is happening to my country? Because my country is the United States of America.
Hi, this is Emily Richards for RAD, Recording Artists, Actors, and Athletes Against Drunk Driving. One person's negligence shattered my life in a single instant. You see, my little sister Annie was killed by a drunk driver. Please, remember those you love. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and...
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he a... Nureyev?
Nureyev.
Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Sure about that?
Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, hi. How you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh?
Does the name Caravaggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Thank you.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And now Washington, D.C., funny little town. The further you look into it, the further things stick out. You ought to be ashamed. You ought to be destroyed. I'll chop you into little bits and feed you to my dogs.
My frog. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where despair is not an option. Get active. Get politically active. Get out there. Get active. Get involved. Get things done. You know, there's an interesting analysis that I read over the weekend. I forget where I read it. That pointed out that, I think maybe I've got it right here. Yeah, here it is. Cool. That pointed out that while Americans' participation seems to be down in the electoral process, the reality is that in the 1800s, they said, well, 70 to 80% of eligible voters were voting, but only white males could vote. So when you look at it now, even though we have, you know, this, there's been a fairly steady decline since 1972, or basically since the 60s, in voter participation. 62.8% in 1960 voted in the Kennedy-Nixon election. It went down to 55% in 1972. And, you know, it's about half of eligible voters, but that's a lot more people than it was in the previous century, because we have enfranchised women and we've enfranchised people of color, and that's, you know, it's a good thing. So, but the main reason that people cite for not getting involved is the erosion of faith in government. They say the government doesn't care about them or the government is toxic, and this is people buying into the conservative propaganda machine, which says the government's the problem, government is evil. People at that point, they go, well, screw it, why vote? They're just going to do nasty stuff anyway. See, this is what the cons want you to think, so that you will not participate. By the way, Steve in Humboldt County raised the question, declaring war and all that sort of thing. John Dean had some thoughts on this. Let me just quickly share them with you here.
While impeachment is a highly political process, there's no question that George Bush has committed an impeachable offense. This doesn't mean that I'm saying he's going to be impeached, because I'm not in that position. I make a legal analysis of it, if you will.
And what's the impeachable offense?
To show how clearly this is exactly the kind of matter that the founders thought should be a cause for impeachment. What is that? To misrepresent information to the Congress, to make the Congress, or have the Congress make a decision. And there's no higher decision than the Congress makes, or that the president does, in going to war.
Yeah, and so that this you know, was the big issue, going to war and lying us into a war. John Dean continues.
The press totally ignored this resolution, and after the president did go to war, he did 48 hours later issue his determination, and it is the most pathetic document I've ever seen any president submit to the Congress of the United States.
Now, what he's talking about is that the resolution that was voted on by Congress that gave George Bush the quote, authority for this action against Iraq, required that he document why he was going to do it. In fact, I'll give you Dean's whole quote right after the break. It's really quite remarkable. And George Bush ignored it. He broke the law, and that's why Dean's is saying, John Dean, who lived through the potential impeachment trial of Richard Nixon, you know, through the events leading up to what almost certainly would have been an impeachment and conviction in the Senate of Richard Nixon, is saying that George Bush has committed an impeachable offense, a high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution. I'll share that with you, and then we'll get back to John Ashcroft's, the questions that we should all be hoping are asked tomorrow when he testifies. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
December 10th, the Bush administration joined 45 states, warning Americans not to eat fish with high mercury levels that can cause birth defects and learning disabilities. But days later, the administration said it wanted to give power plants permission to shower more mercury onto our lakes and streams for 10 years longer than the law allows. Sound fishy? Mr. President, there's a better way to strengthen the State of the Union. Protect us, not the polluters who contributed to your campaign. Enforce the Clean Air Act.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Sterling workers in the greater Washington, D.C. area are finally headed back to work this week after a 7-month-long strike. Under the settlement, Sterling managers agreed to accept their employees' union should the majority show their support for one. They did, and now the mostly immigrant workforce has joined the United Needle Industries and Textile Employees Union, or UNITE. The union has since negotiated a 3-year contract agreement with Sterling, bringing workers a pension plan, free individual and family health coverage, and the largest wage increase in company history.
New proposed rule changes from the Environmental Protection Agency would threaten the health and safety of workers at industrial laundry companies. The EPA is considering waiving the rules that require rags and linen soaked with solvents to be treated as toxic waste. The change would allow this laundry to go straight to the cleaners without the currently intervening step of decontaminating it. The change is the product of heavy lobbying from industrial laundry companies themselves, the largest of which contributed more than $1 million to Republicans in the 2000 election cycle and have raised an estimated $500,000 for George W. Bush's 2004 campaign.
For the first time in South Korean history, unemployed part-time day laborers and migrant workers will be part of a labor union associated with the Federation of Korean Trade Unions. Earlier this month, the Korean Supreme Court ruled that anyone in a temporary jobless state can qualify for union membership, paving the way for a union of jobless and irregular and migrant workers. The new organization is pledged to work towards equalizing the rights of permanent and temporary employees, and it hopes to win greater rights for South Korea's burgeoning population of migrant workers.
Clothier Land's End, in deference to pressure from workers' rights groups and resultant boycotts from several universities, has agreed to work on problems with union busting at a factory in El Salvador that produces its merchandise. Land's End will monitor the Primo factory for 12 months and make donations to another more union-friendly factory in El Salvador where many of those blacklisted at Primo now work. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. How widespread is worker abuse in China? A lot wider than you think. A former International Labor Organization investigator told the U.S. Senate recently that up to 80% of the Chinese contractors making goods for U.S. companies bend or break that country's labor law outright. Most often broken are minimum wage and overtime standards. Senate testimony suggests contractors keep 2 or even 3 sets of books to hide the practice.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
I've seen him run outside looking for
me. Moving right along here, 26 minutes before the hour. Wanted to hear, this is the thing that most Americans have forgotten. When George Bush came before Congress, he said, I would like, well, actually, I'll let John Dean tell you. He does a great job of it. This is a little clip from the Talk Radio News Service. We replay with thanks to them.
Sought a resolution from Congress He sought it back in October of 2002. He wouldn't go to war for many months, so he asked for a very unique resolution. He said, I want to be able to go when I'm ready to go. I don't want to have to come back to the Congress and ask to go again. The Congress had never granted that kind of authority. To do so, and there was still a very, very lively debate at that point, if you recall, about whether there were weapons of mass destruction. So what was done in the House of Representatives, a deal was cracked in the Speaker's office and behind the scenes and in the corridors and what have you. It was worked out with the White House where, yes, they would agree that the resolution would have two conditions. Those conditions would be formal determinations by the President of the United States, one, that diplomatic approaches could not solve the problem of weapons of mass destruction. It just wouldn't work. And secondly, and it's both of them, it's an and, they both have to exist, and that this would be consistent with the war on terror.
The war on terror. And it turns out that, as you know, as John Dean points out, neither of those things actually... were truthful, and when the president did submit his report to Congress, which was required before this, before police action, before a military action, he did it afterwards, and Dean says it's so bad that it's worse than Watergate, worthy of impeachment. I mean, this is strong language from a Republican attorney. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number if you'd like to be on. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California is on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's up?
Hi, good morning, Tom.
Morning.
I want to run something by you, an idea that I had. It seems like whenever somebody, like the conservatives, had attacked Bill Clinton, first it was Whitewater, and they couldn't find anything on him, so they went after his sex life. What I've seen people do before in private situations, I'm wondering if the conservatives are doing this, is basically testing the water to see how the American public will respond to lies, first of all, and second of all, to desensitize us to presidents lying. What do you think about those?
Well, the president's lying is nothing new. I mean, you know, this
I know.
LBJ, Richard Nixon, it just goes way back. I mean,
but I'm talking about lying and then being before the Congress, being accused of lying, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I don't see a grand conspiracy here.
Okay.
What I think are basically kind of crimes of opportunity. The Republicans controlled the House, and so they were able to push through the impeachment of Bill Clinton. The Democrats don't, and so they can't.
Yeah.
And if they could, I suspect that they would be right now. But they can't. They can't call him on the lies and on these things because they don't control the mechanism of allowing things out of committee. And so, I think that's what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Xavier. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. David in Willis, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, David.
Hi. Just wanted to thank you for your show first.
You're welcome.
Also, a point that I want to make was that even if you concede all of the points that the Bush administration and Republican Party make and you give them everything and you say, okay, we believe them. People should still be outraged at just the supreme incompetence. And he's got to go down in history as the most incompetent administration ever in the U.S.
Yeah, but with regard to the economy, with regard to the war in Iraq, with regard to the war on terrorism, with regard to Afghanistan, I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, from day one.
I mean, pick anything that these guys have done. What have they done well other than hand the commons over to large corporations and reduce the quality of our air and water for the first time since Nixon?
Right, it's just always excuses, and so people should just be outraged at the complete incompetence and just realize that, if they are telling the truth, which we know they're not, then they're completely ignorant and incompetent.
Yeah, good point, David. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. The outrage is picking up, in fact. I think all across America, people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. This, like Michael Moore, dude, what happened to my country, or where's my country? It's like the aliens took over or something. No, it's the radicals took over. These people are not conservatives. Although they've reinvented the word conservative to describe them, they are extremists. They are radicals. They are feudalists. They want to return America back to the feudal state that we had during what was called the Gilded Age, the period from the late 1870s through around 1910, when there was no middle class, essentially. The middle class got wiped out. And the response to this, of course, was the progressive and populist movement, which led to a lot of very good reforms in the early part of the 20th century. The direct election of the Senate in 1917, the ability of women to vote in 1920, things like this. But it was this was the high watermark of conservative economics, was the building of the empires of Rockefeller and Carnegie and Mellon and Morgan. And yes, let's return to that. And back to John Ashcroft here. Yeah, question number three. Between January 20th and September 11, 90, okay, so this is between the time he took office and the time that we got hit by bin Laden, were the FBI field offices instructed to increase surveillance of known suspected terrorists? If so, why has Ashcroft been completely unable up to this point to provide the 9/11 Commission with any evidence of this? Condi Rice, for example, said, and I quote from her testimony, "The FBI tasked all 56 of its U.S. field offices to increase surveillance of known suspected terrorists and to reach out to known informants who might have information on terrorist activities," end quote. Again, you know, raising the question of her veracity, of whether she might have lied under oath, because Commissioner Jamie Gorelick said, quote, "We have no record of that. The Washington field office internal terrorism people say they never heard about the threat. They never heard about the warnings. Special agents in charge around the country, Miami in particular, had no knowledge of this." Newsweek reported that Ashcroft rebuffed specific requests by the FBI to discuss counterterrorism with special agents in charge. At a spring meeting in 2001 in Quantico, Virginia, the FBI headquarters, Ashcroft told Louis Free that his priorities were violent crime and drugs. And when Free said that those were not his priorities and began discussing counterterrorism, Louis Free later testified, quote, "Ashcroft didn't want to hear about it." Tim Romer, you know, one of the commissioners, raised this, and this is why I think that Ashcroft's testimony tomorrow, if they ask him the hard questions, may be even more. You know, you want to know who dropped the ball here. In my opinion, yeah, Condi Rice dropped the ball. George Bush dropped the ball. They were focused on Iraq and oil and avenging George's daddy and election strain. You know, Karl Rove with his perpetual campaign for the presidency, his Lee Atwater strategy of, you know, we've got to have at least a couple of wars during the first 4 years to get the American people pumped up and behind us. They've got to be quick. They've got to be successful. You know, we're not going to make the mistake that George Sr. made of having a war and then having it go wrong, or not completing it in time and getting the bounce, but then the bounce fades. We're gonna have a, you know, as George Bush said, this is gonna last at least 5 years. He said this in year one, right after 9/11. He says this war on terrorism is gonna last at least 5 years. And there's long enough to cross an election cycle. So here we have Tim Romer saying, "The FBI is the key here. Nothing went down the chain to the FBI field offices." So question number three for John Ashcroft tomorrow. In our dreams, as Jug Legume points out in this article the Center for American Progress published, article number three, if you really did instruct your field offices to increase surveillance of known terrorists, why haven't you been able to prove offer any evidence of it? And if there is no evidence of it and you didn't do it, then why do you keep telling us you did? Question number four, after 9/11, why did Ashcroft slash almost $1 billion from an emergency FBI request to bolster counterterrorism efforts?
Immediately after 9/11, the FBI made a $1.5 billion request for emergency resources to combat terrorism. This from Louis Freeh. This is, you know, the director of the FBI. We need $1.5 billion to fight terrorism. We know they're in the country. We know they're planning nasty stuff. You know, it's not just we who know it. It's been in the newspaper. Ashcroft cut that by two-thirds. He cut $1 billion out. Why? And where did that money go? Question number four for John Ashcroft. 1-866-889-8894. Let's take a question from you. Terry in Wheaton, Maryland is on the line. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's happening?
Well, I read in this week's, and everyone actually can read it, there's an extensive piece in, I don't know why I'm fading out, either Time or Newsweek, one of the two, but in which, you know, George Bush tells his father that we're going to finish the job. And, you know, this is, to me, this is nothing more than a personal crusade for him.
Well, there's a bunch of components. I think that that's certainly one of them. There's also the fact that, as Dick Cheney pointed out, Iraq is sitting on 10% of the world's oil. That's very significant, to quote Dick Cheney. And number three, there were forces within the administration, particularly Wolfowitz and Pearl, who were suggesting that we needed to have a heavier foot in the Middle East to protect our oil interests in the Middle East and to protect Israel, but in particular to protect our oil interests, that Saudi Arabia was you know, tottering. And, in fact, Osama bin Laden had been saying from the get-go that he would go away. He would stop attacking us if we would take our troops out of Saudi Arabia. And so they wanted to get our troops out of Saudi Arabia. We now did. We just did that a couple of months ago. We finally pulled the last of them out. But this was the thorn in the side of the fundamentalist Muslims. And so there was that. And then there was the point that, you know, there's nothing like a war to stimulate the economy. So you've got all these. I mean, there's a whole bunch of in the minds of the Bush administration good reasons to go to war.
Except that this war didn't stimulate the economy.
Well, I think it has. I think that the reason why the economy has bounced back to the extent that it has, and, of course, we're not seeing jobs recovering because of the structural problems that conservative economics have brought us. We've talked on this program that, you know, from Taft-Hartley up through Ronald Reagan busting unions. But you know, the stock market is back up. There is money going into the economy from the government. We are borrowing. We've borrowed $1 trillion from our children. And we're giving that money to George Bush's friends. And they're spending some of it, and that's stimulating the economy.
Well, you keep up the good work. You have a great show.
Thanks, Terry. I'll do it. And thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate the call. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Question number five for John Ashcroft tomorrow. Beginning in the summer of 2001, you stopped flying on commercial airplanes. Why? Why is it that a month before 9/11... you, Mr. Ashcroft, stopped flying on commercial airplanes? And why didn't you suggest that the rest of us might consider something like that? You were traveling exclusively on leased jet aircraft instead of commercial airlines. At the time, the FBI refused to identify what the threat was, when it was detected, or who made it. And, when Ashcroft was asked by a reporter to explain further, he said, why did you do this? He says, because of potential threats on his life, not out of fears about terrorist hijackings. When he was asked by a reporter to explain further, he, quote, walked from the room without comment, end quote. When the CIA was made aware of this, they said that they were unaware of specific threats against any cabinet member. In other words, as far as the CIA knew, there weren't any threats specifically against Ashcroft. So what did he know that caused him to start charging the taxpayers $1,600 an hour to fly on a private jet? Question number five for the 9/11 Commission. 1-866-889-8894. Mark in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great.
Hey, it's the first time listening to your show. I do enjoy it. It is a different point of view from what I'm used to hearing. But there is one thing I think you're failing to mention about the Clinton administration, the FBI, and Janet Reno. When the FBI did have information on, on some possible terrorist activity in the United States, and the agents themselves wanted to further investigate it, they had to get approval through Janet Reno. She turned them down time and time again to continue their investigation on some of these pilots. They're eventually responsible for September 11th.
Well, if that's the case, then how is it that the FBI arrested one of those pilots up in Wisconsin or Minnesota?
Well, they arrested them on non-terrorist-related activities. They were visa violations or immigration violations.
Yeah.
There were offices in the United States, specifically in Phoenix, that had specific information, but were ordered not to pursue the investigation through Janet Reno's office.
Well, I'd like to see some documentation on that, Mark. If you could post that on our message board, I'd love to see it.
Well, I don't have it personally, but I can assure you that it's there.
Well, I have not.
To
I have.
Dig into it.
Yeah, I believe you, but I haven't seen it. So, you know,
okay. It's a two-way street. Both administrations have.
I don't think the Clinton administration are angels either. It's the Tom Harbin program. 10 minutes before the hour.
All right.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order 2 bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get 2 bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive 2 free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value, free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Nitrates from the Midwest are a major nuisance in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Every spring, a vast expanse of the Gulf of Mexico loses so much oxygen that people describe it as a dead zone where fish cannot survive. The problem begins when nutrients come down the Mississippi River and feed huge blooms of algae. Some experts say the dead zone would cover less of the Gulf if healthy wetlands covered more of the upper Midwest. The nutrients that cause the problem are nitrates that are used as fertilizer on farm fields. When too much fertilizer is used, the nitrates get into groundwater. From there, they seep into tributaries of the Mississippi, and then they're on their way to the Gulf. Jean Barr is a hydrogeology professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's an expert on contaminants in groundwater. She says nitrates travel easily in groundwater, and that's one of several reasons why they're a problem.
First of all, we're adding nitrogen to the landscape, and so there's a huge excess overall because nitrate is so soluble in water. And we are farming right up to the edges of streams, which means that the distance that the groundwater moves through the subsurface before it gets to the stream is fairly short.
Microbes in waterlogged soil near these farm fields will chew up nitrates and break them down into harmless nitrogen gas. But a lot of wetlands in the upper Midwest have been drained and turned into farm fields. Barr says that's short-circuited the natural processes that break down the nitrates in groundwater. Experts say restoration of wetlands in the upper Midwest is an essential part of reducing the impact of nitrates on the Gulf of Mexico. That problem is widely regarded as a national issue because it affects one of the most important fisheries in U.S. waters. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Ken, Star, how do you sleep at night? The perfect tool of the radical right. You think it's over now, we indict you for the death of democracy. By a powerful few.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Question number seven for John Ashcroft. These compiled by Judd Legume, put out by the Center for American Progress. Excellent, an excellent summary of the real issues that really ought to be raised tomorrow. On October 2001, Ashcroft appeared with President Bush at a press conference to unveil a list of 22 most wanted terrorists. 30 months later, one of them is dead. By best estimates, we're not really sure, but everybody assumes. And one of them has been captured, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. The other 20 are still at large. Why? In a speech in October of 2003, this just last October, Ashcroft bragged that, quote, two-thirds of al-Qaeda's leadership is either in custody or dead. Why is it that the 22 most wanted terrorists, 20 of them, are still running around loose? And what resources were moved from the war on terrorism? This kind of feeds into this. But this is the point that Richard Clark made. What resources were moved from the war on terrorism that caused us not to catch these guys into the war against Iraq, the war against Saddam Hussein, that caused us, as Richard Clark said, to put on hold for a year and a half. Now, you know, functionally a year and a half, because there was all the ramping up to it. They had to really whip that thing up in the summer of 2002 so that it would become an election issue. You recall the vote was in October. This was the October surprise of 2002 for the Republicans. You know, whipping up patriotism here. With us, you're against us. We got these weapons of mass destruction. We got to do something that's terrible. Look at this guy. He's got uranium. He's got weapons. He's got anthrax. He's got poison. Are you, you know, and you know, Democrats, they don't want to do anything about it. How dare they? And so what kind of resources were pulled off the war on terrorism, the investigations of these terrorists, in order to go after Osama bin Laden? See, here now I'm doing. In order to go after Saddam Hussein. And put nearly 700 of our young soldiers, young men and women, in their graves, thousands wounded, in harm's way. What resources were pulled to do that? It's the Tom Hartman radio program, thinking about what John Ashcroft should answer tomorrow morning.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Had to finish getting the newsletter out before I could do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. George W. Bush was told a month before September 11, 2001, that Al-Qaeda members were in the U.S. and the FBI had detected suspicious activity consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, according to a secret memo the White House released under pressure on Saturday. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice insisted in her public testimony to the 911 Commission last week that the memo contained mostly historical information and did not warn of any impending attacks inside the United States. Her account was contradicted by the fact that the memo included information from 3 months beforehand that Al-Qaeda members were trying to enter the United States for an attack with explosives, and there was even mention of hijacking airplanes. George W. Bush says more American casualties may come in Iraq, but we're plenty tough. Almost 50 American soldiers and more than 550 Iraqis are dead in the violence that spread across the country last week. Bush called it a tough week. Bush attended an Easter Sunday service at Fort Hood, Texas, a base that has lost at least 9 service members in the past week of fighting. After the service, Bush told reporters the U.S. campaign in Iraq is right. He says it's hard to tell if such fighting will continue. The White House is battling to keep a more than 800-page report on the 911 terror attack secret, including unheeded warnings given to Bush during the summer of 2001, suggesting that Al-Qaeda was planning an upcoming attack against the United States that raises questions about how Bush responded. One such CIA briefing in July 2001 predicted that Osama bin Laden was about to launch a terror strike in the coming weeks, the congressional investigators found. The intelligence briefing went on to say the attack will be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties against U.S. facilities and interests. Attack preparations have been made. Attacks will occur with little or no warning.
More after this.
This week on TBTM Radio.
You see when all this hell is breaking out in Iraq. He's home clearing brush.
Well, I like what somebody says. You know, whenever there's trouble, George takes a powder. He's gone, folks.
That's what he did after that August 6th presidential briefing.
I don't see how I could possibly have imagined a plane crashing into something and destroying it. I never watched a John Wayne movie or had a drink called what? A kamikaze.
Kamikaze.
They named a freaking drink after it, idiot.
TBTM Radio, on the web at TakeBackTheMedia.com.
A British man who sold all of his possessions, including his clothes, stood in a rented tuxedo on Sunday, surrounded by family and friends, and bet everything on a single spin of the roulette wheel. Ashley Revelle, a 32-year-old Londoner, sold all his possessions in March, took $135,300 to the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, did some low-stakes gambling, and then placed everything he had left on red. The wheel was spun. A crowd of supporters, including his mom and dad from London, went wild. The ball bobbled over the slots and landed on red 7, and Revelle walked away with $270,600. This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
The only thing madder than mad cow disease is our government's mad cow policies. Take the case of Creekstone Farms Premium Beef, a small enterprising company in Kansas that produces top quality beef. To assure both U.S. and foreign buyers that its product is free of mad cow disease, Creekstone said that it would exceed USDA's minimal testing standards and pay to have every single one of its cows privately tested. Great! Who could be against more testing and such innovative entrepreneurship? The U.S. Department of Agriculture, for one. The big beef lobbyists, for two. In another case of Bushite bourgeois, USDA notified Creekstone that it does not allow private testing, even by certified labs. This from an administration that's privatizing everything from its wars to your water supply. Why? The official rationale is that only the government can assure food safety. But how can testing 100% of cows be less safe than USDA's program that inspects less than 1%? The real reason for USDA's intransigence is that the big beef companies don't want to do 100% testing themselves, and they want no competition from anyone who does. They say that Creekstone's testing would, quote, mislead us consumers, for we might think that 100% testing produces a safer product. Aside from the fact that more testing does assure more safety, Creekstone is not even making such a claim. It's only claiming that, indeed, it tests 100% of its cows. Then it's up to us consumers to decide in the marketplace which beef we prefer. But the Bushites and the big beef lobbyists refuse to allow such consumer choice, declaring that Creekstone cannot advertise that every ounce of its beef is fully tested. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a pile of BS! To help bring sanity to Washington's mad cow policies, call the USDA's comment office, 202-720-5627.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec? Nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. CommonDreams.org, just at the very top of the page there, they published an article I wrote on Friday and submitted this morning, and redid a draft of it about the outsourcing of labor in this article. And you know, I won't read it or try and tell you. It's a summary of rants you've heard many times if you're a longtime listener to the program. But basically, I'm suggesting it's time for us to go back to putting a tariff on labor. That historically, that we've put tariffs, import taxes, we've put tariffs on the products of labor. For example, if you wanted to make something overseas, if you wanted to make a product overseas, you wanted to make a pair of shoes overseas, and there was a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes if you made it in the United States, but it's only 10 cents worth of labor in that pair of shoes if you make it in Malaysia, then that's fine. You can make the shoes in Malaysia. We're not trying to stop anybody from starting a business or doing business. However, when you import those into the United States, you have to pay a 90-cent tariff or tax so that the labor cost in that pair of shoes is still equalized. It's still a dollar. And from the 1700s up until Bill Clinton signed NAFTA and GATT, that basically is how America has protected its workforce. Kind of, step one. And I point out that Thomas Jefferson laid this out just laid it out. And that David Ricardo has been badly twisted by economists in justifying it. So anyhow, what I'm suggesting is that now we have services which are being done overseas rather than just manufacturing. And we have the mechanism to impose a tariff on them, too. And say, you know, fine, if you want to answer phones in India for, you know, $1 an hour instead of $12 an hour here in the United States, that's fine, you can do that. But you have to pay an $11 an hour tax on that labor. And people say, oh, that's protectionism. Oh, you can't have protectionism. That's terrible. Yes, it is protectionism, and it's what most other countries in the world do. The reason why China has, one of the reasons why China has such a huge trade surplus with the United States is that they protect their domestic industries. You want to import American goods into China? You're going to have to pay a tax. You want to import American goods into Japan? You're going to have to pay tariffs. Yes, you know, there's a lot of countries that have signed WTO, the World Trade, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the multilateral agreements which created the World Trade Organization. There are a lot of companies that have signed that, and a lot of barriers have gone down, as it were. A lot of tariffs have been eliminated, but not entirely. We still have hundreds of tariffs in the United States. It's just that most of them are down around the 2, 3, 4, 5% range, although there are a few tariffs to protect a few favored industries. Anyhow, last night I was flying home from visiting a friend of mine in New York. Interesting. This is an aside, but he just went through chemo and radiation, and he was taking pain medication for, you know, of course, the pain associated with it. You know, burning away part of your body is not a pleasant thing, and his insurance company said that, yes, your doctor prescribed this amount of painkiller for you, but we will only pay for this amount, a less amount, because we think that that's all that's necessary. Here you've got an insurance company making medical decisions. And you know, he was going along with it. I was amazed. You have no choice, basically, in America. I mean, that's you know, we are rationing health care in the United States, and we're rationing medications, and the rationing is being done by corporate America. Anyhow, I just went down to visit him over the weekend, and I was flying back home last night, and I was sitting in the airport reading Forbes, and which had been sitting on the table before I arrived. And here I thought this was really interesting. During the last 10 years, China's world trade has grown by an average of 16% to $851 billion. Now, 21% of that is American trade. That is trade that China exports to the United States. So you got roughly a little less than $200 billion of stuff that China is shipping into the United States every year. And so, you know, I just, you know, okay, let's say that for every $5,000 worth of stuff, there's a job. Now, this is pretty arbitrary, but another way to say it would be to say, let's say the average worker is making $5,000. It doesn't quite work that way, but if you just look at the $5,000, then it works out to, we have created 40 million jobs in China. Now, there's other ways to do the calculations. There's a bunch of other ways, and I want to talk about them one of these days at greater length. But it just popped out at me. It was like, whoa, you know, $250 billion. That if we were doing that here in the United States, how many jobs would that represent? Well, it wouldn't represent 40 million jobs because we wouldn't be paying people $5,000 a person. It might represent, at $50,000 a person, 4 million jobs. But did you see this? This newsflash, this New York Times article pointed this out. John Ashcroft is at it again. This, you know, the important stuff that the FBI is doing instead of looking for terrorists, they have given stern warning to American publishers I suppose I should be concerned about. I'm not a publisher, but I'm a writer, and my books are published by publishers, and I don't want any of them to go out of business. In fact, by the way, our newest book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America, an illustrated book, a comic book, 200 pages more or less, is now available. You can click to it off tomhartman.com. There's a link to a whole website about it, and also, of course, you can find it at amazon.com and in any bookstore. But anyhow, here's publishers. The administration has given a stern warning to American publishers. Publishers will face grave legal consequences if they take writings from certain countries and edit them. What is this about? If you take a poem that was written in Cuba and you edit it, if you reorder paragraphs or sentences, correct syntax or grammar, replace inappropriate words, or add illustrations, then you can be hit with a $500,000 fine and go to prison for 10 years if you do that for things that were written in Cuba, Libya, North Korea, or Iran. I can understand saying, okay, we want to punish these countries, we won't let you import their products. And I can even understand saying, I disagree with it, but I can understand saying, see, I think it's stupid policy to isolate nations. I mean, if you look at the history of isolation, what it has historically done is it has strengthened dictators rather than weakened them. There are a few exceptions to the rule. Libya, for example, recently, although I would say that probably our sanctions against Libya helped Gaddafi more than hurt him in the early years. Eventually, it kind of got to him. But he said, hey, you know, come on in. But the bottom line here is, you know, I really don't think that, sanctions and blockades and things like that are useful. But even if they were, you know, I could understand somebody saying, okay, you can't import cigars from Cuba because that's supporting Cuban industry. And you can't pay an author in Cuba because that's, sending money to a nation that we have this trade embargo with. But why would we have a law that is now being aggressively enforced by the Ashcroft Justice Department? I mean, this is just a hot new thing here that they've discovered and they're going after. To prosecute people who publish and edit the works of primarily poets. This seems to be targeted mostly at poets who live in countries with oppressive regimes. The New York Times notes, although there has not yet been a prosecution for criminal editing, the mere fact that the rules exist have scared some publishers into rejecting works from Iran and other countries. Wasn't Rumi Iranian? Rumi, the great poet, mystic of Islam? I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Rumi was Iranian. Khalil Gibran was Lebanese, so I guess he doesn't count. I'm pretty sure. But I think that Rumi was Iranian. So now, if you are going to translate the poems of Rumi, you can go to jail for 10 years, if I'm right that Rumi was Iranian. It is startling. Startling. This, my friends, your tax dollars at work, your Justice Department at work. Okay. Margie Burns did this great piece, published in The Populist. And the lead sentence kind of tells it all. Close relatives of President George W. Bush continue to benefit financially from the Iraq invasion, as revealed by sources including regulatory findings. And just share with you a couple of quickies from this, just so you know where your tax dollars are going. St. Louis-based Engineered Support Systems, Inc., EASI, where William H.T. Bush, an uncle of George W. Bush, joined the board of directors in 2000 as a major military contractor. Following the 2000 election and 9/11, the company has seen its federal contracts revenues and stock price increase. What a surprise. They get contracts from all branches of the military. They're listed by the Defense Department as one of its top 100 contractors. $330 million in contracts in 2001. $380 million, George Bush comes in office, $380 million in 2002. And 2003, already over $380 million. The numbers come in with a lag. I realize this is 2004. But these numbers are always, you know, usually published the year after. Former President George H.W. Bush resigned in the fall of 2003 from the giant Carlyle Group, heavily into military and security sectors, which received $677 million in contracts in 2000 and $2.1 billion in contracts in 2003. Neil M. Bush, a younger brother of George W. Bush, has obtained a $60,000 a year contract from a principal in D.C.-based New Bridge Strategies, a private firm set up to generate contracts in Iraq. And Marvin P. Bush is getting into the act, too. I'll tell you about that right after this. 20 minutes past the hour. This is Tom Hartman.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Walmart doesn't just dominate the discount retail and grocery industries. It's muscling in on a much more lucrative market, campaign contributions. Walmart is currently the second largest overall donor in the 2004 election cycle, according to an analysis by the Center for Responsive Politics, giving 85% of its donations to Republicans and 15% to Democrats. In the 2002 federal election cycle, Walmart came in 71st among the top 100 donors.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, 15 $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis Digilink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the ToonTracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the Pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original ToonTracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.toontrackersystems.com. www.toontrackersystems.com. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Okay, we got a Marvin P. Bush. A controversial $327 million contract was awarded in January by the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA. This is, you know, Paul Bremer and company, right? $327 million in January was given to Winston Partners. Who is Winston Partners? It's just by coincidence, $327 million. Now, just think about that for a minute. I mean, what would you do with $1 million? Well, this is $327 million. And that money went to Winston Partners, the private investment firm of Marvin P. Bush. Good old Marvin. Now, through that investment firm, the money went to Noor, N-O-U-R, USA, a Virginia company formed last May. And Noor, USA is under scrutiny for its ties to Ahmed Chalabi, the convicted bank swindler that we've put in charge of running Iraq. The new company, the Noor Group, or consortium, also has ties to Bush family interests. The Noor Group claims ties to several countries backed or owned by Winston Partners. This from this article by Margie Burns in The Populist, all in the profiteering first family. By Winston Partners, Winston being Marvin P. Bush's company, Hobart West, a Fortune 500 personnel services company, Logotel, a clothing company, and Axolotl, a computer services company and medical care. Other companies in Winston Partners' portfolio include AMSEC, where Bush's partner L. Scott Andrews sits on the board of directors. This is George Bush's former business partner, also benefiting from federal contracts. And the new CEO of AMSEC, AMSEC, Michael Braham, who formerly worked for L. Paul Bremer, who is now the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. And so it goes. So Margie wraps this up. She says, it looks more than ever as though Bush planned all along to invade Iraq, but whatever his motives, it is certain that the war benefits his own family. You know, there ought to be a law. Abraham Lincoln. It's really fascinating. You read Carl Sandburg's biography of Abraham Lincoln, and the thing that made Lincoln the craziest, he was horrified by the carnage of the Civil War. He was just, you know, the deaths, the destruction, just you know, ripped him apart. But the thing that really got him perhaps the most was the war profiteering. He was so upset about that. He was so angry about that. He was so he was beside himself about war profiteering. This is all these quotes from Lincoln about the war profiteering. And you know, we ought to just shoot these guys. He made that comment at one point. It's in fact, I use it as an epigraph in Unequal Protection. And here we have, and these were, you know, people in the Lincoln administration, but Lincoln never would have thought of having his you know, a member of his own family set up a defense contracting firm and make money off the, you know, it would have been unimaginable. But in the Bush administration, it's not only imaginable, it is, as we discover, business as usual. Marvin Bush, George Bush, George Bush Sr., Carlyle Group, right on down the list, sucking at the public trough and making millions of dollars as our young men and women are dying in Iraq. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Sterling workers in the greater Washington, D.C. area are finally headed back to work this week after a 7-month-long strike. Under the settlement, Sterling managers agreed to accept their employees' union should the majority show their support for one. They did, and now the mostly immigrant workforce has joined the United Needle Industries and Textile Employees Union, or UNITE. The union has since negotiated a 3-year contract agreement with Sterling, bringing workers a pension plan, free individual and family health coverage, and the largest wage increase in company history.
New proposed rule changes from the Environmental Protection Agency would threaten the health and safety of workers at industrial laundry companies. The EPA is considering waiving the rules that require rags and linen soaked with solvents to be treated as toxic waste. The change would allow this laundry to go straight to the cleaners without the currently intervening step of decontaminating it. The change is the product of heavy lobbying from industrial laundry companies themselves, the largest of which contributed more than $1 million to Republicans in the 2000 election cycle and have raised an estimated $500,000 for George W. Bush's 2004 campaign.
For the first time in South Korean history, unemployed part-time day laborers and migrant workers will be part of a labor union associated with the Federation of Korean Trade Unions. Earlier this month, the Korean Supreme Court ruled that anyone in a temporary jobless state can qualify for union membership, paving the way for a union of jobless and irregular and migrant workers. The new organization is pledged to work towards equalizing the rights of permanent and temporary employees, and it hopes to win greater rights for South Korea's burgeoning population of migrant workers.
Clothier Land's End, in deference to pressure from workers' rights groups and resultant boycotts from several universities, has agreed to work on problems with union busting at a factory in El Salvador that produces its merchandise. Land's End will monitor the Primo factory for 12 months and make donations to another more union-friendly factory in El Salvador where many of those blacklisted at Primo now work. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. How widespread is worker abuse in China? A lot wider than you think. A former International Labor Organization investigator told the U.S. Senate recently that up to 80% of the Chinese contractors making goods for U.S. companies bend or break that country's labor law outright. Most often broken are minimum wage and overtime standards. Senate testimony suggests contractors keep 2 or even 3 sets of books to hide the practice.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My duty. to spend and to buy, to prove to Bin Laden I'll shop till I die. I'm a world-class consumer, I'm sure of my role. I vote with my dollars for corporate control. I'll prove that I'm royal and rush to the store, where spending is my contribution to war, and the American flag's on the counter for sale. We're all made in China by prisoners in jail.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our thinking person's book of the month this month is How Democratic is the American Constitution by Robert Dahl. And we're going to have Dr. Dahl on our program here later on in the month. He's a professor at Yale University. And it's an amazing, fascinating book. And you can find it at BuzzFlash.com. Just go to BuzzFlash.com and you'll find something on there that says Tom Hartman's Thinking Person's Book Club. And I think you'll find it very, very useful. We're going to be discussing it here at some length. There's a good review of it there also. And let you know that commondreams.org has a new article that we just put up. You may find interesting. Also, our chat room is alive and well, full of folks. If you want to drop in, go to tomhartman.com and click on the chat button. It'll take you to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. And if you want to, and of course, we have a message board as well. You can leave messages in the Democratic Forum, or you can go to the message board that is attached to our website. And there's one specifically for the radio show, the radio program, and you can discuss the topics of the day there as you wish. So, all of that said, Bernie Sanders has published this great piece outing corporate welfare. And by the way, it's the last half of the third hour of our program here. If there's any topic that's on your mind that you'd like me to talk about, or you'd like to cover, or you'd get my thoughts on it, or you just want to share your thoughts, feel free. Feel free. I'm going to do some. I got a couple of things here that I was going to cover, but feel free to call 1-866-889-8894, and we'll put you on the air. The lines are open at the moment. Here's now Bernie Sanders. Since 2001, Motorola has laid on. Consider these. This is how bizarre it is. Since 2001, Motorola has laid off 42,900 workers and invested $3.4 billion in China while receiving. Now get that. Motorola, $3.5 billion in China. They laid off 42,900 workers in the United States. Now, how did we respond to that? We the people, our tax dollars, your government and mine? They received $190 million from the U.S. Export-Import Bank and $16 million from the Advanced Technology Program. General Electric, since 1975, General Electric eliminated more than a quarter million U.S. jobs, 260,000 U.S. jobs, and invested over $1.5 billion in China, while receiving more than $2.5 billion from the Export-Import Bank, more than $100 million from the Fossil Energy Research and Development Program, and $8.2 million in corporate welfare from the Advanced Technology Program. Are you starting to notice a trend here? Since 1990, Boeing laid off 135,000 workers, increasingly outsourcing design work to China, Russia, and Japan, while receiving $18 billion in corporate welfare from the Export-Import Bank. These figures from Congressman Bernie Sanders. Since 2001, General Motors laid off 37,500 workers, had invested $3.5 billion building manufacturing plants in China while receiving over $500 million from the U.S. Export-Import Bank. They also received $8.1 million from the Advanced Technology Program and more than $8.5 million from the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles. GM has recently announced that it will be buying $6 billion in auto parts from China every year, up from its current $2.8 billion last year. IBM, since 2001, IBM has laid off 15,000 workers and signed deals to train 100,000 software specialists. Where are they training these 100,000 new software specialists? These 100,000 new jobs over the next 3 years? That they're doing, by the way, with a $20 million loan from the U.S. Export-Import Bank? Where are these folks, these 100,000 workers that IBM's going to train? They're in China. And while Halliburton laid off 10,000 workers when they merged with Dresser Industries and has used foreign subsidiaries to evade U.S. taxes, they and their subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, received $551 million in corporate welfare from the Export-Import Bank since 2000. A half a billion dollars in corporate welfare since this administration took over, has gone to Halliburton. Halliburton. And during that time, they laid off 10,000 workers, at least in the United States. So Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation to change this. It's called the Defending American Jobs Act of 2004. He has 50 co-sponsors. And I think it's a noble effort, and I congratulate him on it. And I can tell you that as long as the Republicans control the House and the Senate, it's not going to go anywhere. Which is why it's so important that you register to vote and that you not just get sucked into this, you know, mistaken idea that the only election of any consequence is the election for President of the United States. Ain't so. Now, I'd like to get back to the point that I had started on in the first hour about Saudi Arabia. Actually, let me set that aside for just a moment. I want to share with you, this is great. Judge Roy Moore is now running for president. You got Ralph Nader on the left, and you got Roy Moore on the right. www.formore.com is the website of Roy Moore for president. And he is concerned that George Bush has betrayed America. Here are there's 15 ways that George Bush has betrayed America. Number one, George W. Bush betrayed Roy Moore. Well, that's certainly a betrayal of America. When Justice Roy Moore and his supporters declared that the Ten Commandments have a place in America's courts of law, or at least declared that 2.5-ton statues of them, graven images of them, have a place, George W. Bush cut and run. Bush pretended he didn't even know us, like Peter denying Jesus. Roy Moore's objection number one. Objection number two, George W. Bush betrayed Lieutenant General William Boykin. Remember William Boykin? He's the guy who said, our God is bigger than their God. Mr. Boykin, Freud would have something to say about that. Anyhow, when Boykin, from formore.com, Roy Moore for president, when Boykin told the truth about America's war for terror, saying that it is really a war against Satan, Bush denied knowing anything about it. We know very well that Bush and Boykin have talked about this very thing in the White House together, says Roy Moore. But Bush pretended he didn't even know about it. Amazing the things you learn, right? Reading these right-wing websites. After 9/11, George W. This is number three ways in which George Bush has let down Roy Moore and America. After September 11, 2001, George W. Bush has engaged in a silly ecumenical project. Wow, a polysyllabic word. A silly ecumenical project to try to pretend that all religions are really the same and equally valid. Now, isn't that silly? All religions equally valid? General Boykin is courageous enough to say that America is a Christian nation. Bush tries to pretend that he does not think so. We need a president, says Judge Roy Moore, running for president. who will be honest about these things and not try to cover up the differences between the real differences between Christianity and Islam. You think the jihadists are all in Saudi Arabia? This one's in Alabama. Number four, George W. Bush campaigned as a responsible fiscal conservative, but he has created the largest budget deficits in history. As Pastor William Baldwin points out, under Bush's leadership, the Republican Congress has outspent their Democratic predecessors. Bush's policies raise our local taxes, and George W. Bush has yet to veto a single spending bill. Well, Judge Moore, in his defense, he's threatening to veto the highway bill, because it actually might create union jobs here in the United States. Can't have that. Number five, under George W. Bush, the Republican Party has become the party of big government. The government has grown bigger and bigger with more agencies and bureaucracies and enforcement programs. Yeah. Hey, maybe I should vote for this guy. Roy, come on. Number six, George W. Bush seems to have a problem being honest. Now, keep in mind, this is, you know, www.formore.com. Roy W. Moore's, Judge Roy Moore, the Ten Commandments judge, his running for president website. You know, we should, you know, if the Republicans are going to fund Ralph Nader, as they are in some places now, it's pretty clear. Maybe George Soros should toss this guy some money. Number six, George W. Bush seems to have a problem being honest. Bush has been caught in many lies. He's lied about September 11. He's lied about Iraq. He's lied about his budget. The sad fact is that George W. Bush has lost all the moral authority that a president of the United States must have. Bush is a poor example for our children, who we try to teach to be honest. I'm reading this from Judge Roy Moore's website, the Ten Commandments judge, the darling of Fox TV. I shouldn't laugh. I'm sorry. This actually is very serious stuff. Number seven, America is supposed to be the land of freedom, not the land of spies. See, what this points out is that there is a very real and legitimate fracturing in the Republican Party, and there are issues that transcend liberal and conservative that really just have to do with are you really and truly for lack of a better phrase, a patriotic American. I realize that's a phrase that's been terribly usurped and misused, and it means different things to different people. But you know, are we really interested in what's best for America and for the people of America and for the world ultimately as well, knowing that the two are related? You can't separate them. Or are we just interested in what's best for George Bush and his family and his political cronies? So anyhow, here we have Judge Roy Moore, number seven. America is supposed to be the land of freedom, not the land of spies. Yet George W. Bush has created new programs for the government to spy on ordinary law-abiding Americans. Through the Patriot Act and Total Information Awareness, Bush has made America the land of Big Brother. Number eight. Reasons why you should vote for Judge Roy Moore for president instead of George Bush if you're a conservative. From the formore.com website. Number eight, we criticize Bill Clinton for having his donors sleep in the Lincoln bedroom of the White House. Now George W. Bush is doing the same, arranging for his big fundraisers to sleep overnight in the White House. That's a shame, says Roy Moore. Number nine, just like Bill Clinton, the Bush administration uses focus groups to set its policy and its speeches. Judge Roy Moore has more integrity than that. Number 10. From the reasons why you should vote for Judge Roy Moore for president instead of George Bush, if you happen to be a conservative. George W. Bush promised that he would promote a pro-life agenda, but now both George W. Bush and his wife say they oppose overturning Roe v. Wade because George W. Bush is really pro-choice. You heard it here, folks. You heard it here first. Well, you heard it from Judge Roy Moore. Number 11. The reasons why conservatives should vote for Judge Roy Moore. Bush is two-faced and insecure about homosexuality. He says he opposes gay marriage, but then refuses to oppose civil unions for homosexuals. He also refuses to be consistent on hiring gays in the government, allowing for other offices to fire gays because of their sexual orientation. But he hires several gays himself. There's exclamation point there. Either Bush should be pro-gay or anti-gay. Make a decision, Bush. Boy, his own people are. It's this. Number 12. Bush has taken part in Shinto ceremonies. Shinto, by the way, if you're not familiar with it, is the more or less official religion of Japan. It's a distant cousin of Buddhism and Confucianism. But it's uniquely Japanese. Bush has taken part in Shinto ceremonies, bowing down to idols at a Shinto temple in Japan. Blasphemy and idolatry is not Christian behavior. Judge Roy Moore would never do such a thing. Although he will bow down to an idol of the Ten Commandments, weighing 2.5 tons in the rotunda in Alabama there. Number 13, George W. Bush has actually increased the funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, which funds blasphemy. Number 14, Bush has allowed for experimentation on human embryos. And number 15, Bush has sent American soldiers to serve under United Nations authorities. Judge Roy Moore for president, my friends. www.4formoore.com. Would he make a better president than George W. Bush? He would certainly make a more interesting one. I'll tell you that. 10 minutes before the hour, it's Tom Hartman. I'll be right back.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order 2 bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get 2 bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive 2 free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, formula. You'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
The oceans are massive and seemingly unmanageable, but an author argues for a piecemeal approach. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. The world beneath the ocean is a lot like the land above it, and seeing it that way can help us figure out how to conserve marine life, according to author Rod Fujita.
While the ocean appears to be vast and imperturbable, it's really made up of habitats and living communities, just like the land is. So the same rationale applies to the ocean as does to the land. There are special places. There are vulnerable species in the ocean just as there are on land. So the same kind of conservation ethic should guide our actions in the ocean.
Fujita has written a new book called Heal the Ocean, Solutions for Saving Our Seas. He says while the ocean is an enormous shared resource, we can help it by focusing on its parts. For example, coral reefs. Many of these habitats are suffering from a phenomenon known as bleaching. They're turning white as colorful colonies of algae and other life forms die out due to pollution and warming seawater. Fujita says we might not be able to curb global warming in the short run, but he says reducing pollution, overfishing, and other stresses could help coral reefs recover.
Coral reefs, when you remove the other stresses to them, may have an enhanced capacity to cope with the stress of climate change. I've been out in the South Pacific and in other parts of the world, and I've seen coral reefs come back from tremendous natural disasters like volcanic explosions and huge storms that break off the corals. As long as we're not polluting those or overfishing them, they do have a tremendous resilience and ability to recover.
Fujita says it's not too late to save coral reefs and other marine ecosystems. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded, and the merchants of Spar with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded, and the noise outside was the ringing of revolution.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 4 minutes before the hour. We're nearly at the top of the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Zach in Ohio is on the line. Hey, Zach, what's up?
Yeah, I just have a problem with all the hullabaloo over the Ten Commandments in the courtroom.
Okay.
It's not okay to have a granite statue of them in the lobby, but once you get inside, you place your hand on a Bible and swear to tell the truth, which contain the Ten Commandments.
Actually, you don't do that anymore.
That's kind of a double standard.
Yeah, but they don't do that anymore. I don't know. Did you see the hearings where they put these people under oath? They say, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And you say, yes, I do. And there's no Bible involved.
I was in court a couple of weeks ago and had to swear on a Bible.
Oh, well, but they must do that way in your state. Yeah, I agree that there is some inconsistency. And, frankly, what's the whole point of the Bible? To scare people to think that they're going to, if I lie, is it worse to lie to us and to our fellow human beings than to lie, with your hand in the Bible? I don't think so.
Well, I agree with that. I couldn't understand the double standard, basically.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing with Judge Roy Moore was the big problem with him was that he had an advertising billboard basically going. You know?
Right.
It was like, get this thing out of the rotunda. You know, if it had been a little, placard or something. There's the Ten Commandments around the wall in the Supreme Court building.
Right.
Nobody's proposing to cover it up, but it's not like the featured thing. It's like, here it is. So, And it's interesting when you think about it, really, of the Ten Commandments, there's only two that we have in common. Don't kill and don't steal. We don't have, laws that say that you can only worship one God or that you have to honor your father and mother. So, people who say, well, the American law is based on the Ten Commandments. No, really, there's just an overlap, two of them out of the ten, So, anyhow, it's an interesting one. Zach, I appreciate your call. Great to hear from you.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today. Thanks to Brad Walrod for editing our music. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up and sticking around. Many of you through the whole 3 hours of the program. It's just wonderful to have you there. And thanks to you for listening. I do appreciate your patronage. You're sticking around with us and your patronage of our sponsors as well.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.